This is Brother David Pearce at the Christadelphian Conference 2007, giving the first of four talks on the subject, A Land Flowing with Milk and Honey. And his first part is called Bread Which Strengtheneth Man's Heart. We're going to open by singing hymn 85, followed by prayer. If you'd remain standing for that, please. God who cheered the faithful Joseph in his lone distress, he who bade the shepherd Moses leave the wilderness, summon Israel from the darkness of Egyptian night, he by Moses freed his people with a hand of might. Hymn 85. Heavenly Father, we come before you now in this evening hour to consider that wonderful land, that glorious land upon which your eyes are fixed from the beginning of the year to the end of it. And we are grateful that we have been associated through the Lord Jesus with that same land which you promised to Abraham. We have become heirs of promise, as his descendants were who left Egypt so long ago. And we look forward to that time we have sung of when Jesus will come again to lead his people back to that promised land and to settle them there forever in peace and in righteousness. And now as we go back in time and we consider their feelings as they left the slavery of Egypt and the excitement that they must have felt as they came for the first time to that land you have promised so long, we pray you will help us to enter into their excitement and to share in their enthusiasm for this great land that you have promised, and to see that wonderful law you gave them, which will provide food for every family and give them a happy and enduring existence in that country. So now then, Lord, please bless us as we read and study together, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's take a reading, brothers and sisters, from Deuteronomy chapter 11. Brother Malcolm Cross is going to come forward and read those verses to us, please.
Deuteronomy 11, verses 8 to 21. Reading from the English Standard Version, ESV. You shall therefore keep the whole commandment that I command you today, that you may be strong, and go in and take possession of the land that you are going over to possess, and that you may live long in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to give to them and to their offspring, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land that you are entering to take possession of is not like the land of Egypt, from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and irrigated it, like a garden of vegetables. But the land that you are going over to possess it is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water by the rain from heaven, a land that the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord your God are always upon it, from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. And if you will indeed obey my commandments that I commanded you today, to love the Lord your God, and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, he will give the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the later rain, that you may gather in your grain and your wine and your oil. And he will give grass in your fields for your livestock, and you shall eat and be full. Take care, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens, that there will be no rain, and the land will yield no fruit, and you will perish quickly off the good land that the Lord is giving you. You shall therefore lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, and you shall bind them as a sign in your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall teach them to your children, talking of them when you are sitting in your house, and when you are walking by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates, that your days and the days of your children may be multiplied in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to give them, as long as the heavens are above the earth.
Thank you, Brother Malcolm. One thing we need to appreciate, brothers and sisters, is that the Israelites had probably been in the land of Egypt for something like 200 years. You can work that out. You know, we're told that it was 430 years at the time of the Exodus from the time when God made the promise to Abraham. And if you take away the ages of all the patriarchs going up to Jacob, you can find that Jacob arrived in Egypt, and you can take off that 210 years, and that leaves something like 200 odd years for them to have been in Egypt itself after the arrival of Jacob with the family from the north. Now, the point about that is, the Israelites would have had no memory of life in Canaan. If you think about it, it's the same as the same distance in time as going from this year, 2007, back to the time of Napoleon and Nelson at the turn of the 19th century. And we have no memory of what England was like at that time. Even our grandfathers can't go back that far to tell us what it was like. So it was like a hidden story. All they had was what was written down, perhaps for them, the life of Abraham and his family. But the land itself was an unknown and quite different to what they were used to down in the land of Egypt. And we know, of course, in the land of Egypt, they had been very seriously oppressed by the Egyptians for some time during that 200 years. This is a quotation from Exodus chapter 1, verse 11. They did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in all manner of service in the field. And all their service wherewith they made them serve was with rigor. Sounds very unpleasant, doesn't it? And obviously it was. And when you go to places like the British Museum, or the Louvre in Paris, you can see pictures and models of what life was like for the ladies in Egypt. This particular young lady, servant girl, making bread, or perhaps the gentleman, busy making bricks from the clay. You can see the clay pit on the extreme left of the picture there, and the clay being moulded into forms, brick-shaped moulds, stood out to dry, and then carried on yokes on the people's backs to the place where they were to be built. And here you can see, just about in the picture, the taskmaster with his whip in his hand, waiting to crack it down on the back of anybody who wasn't working 100%. So that was what life was like when Moses came to them. And Moses came with this wonderful message. God had seen the oppression of his people in Egypt. He heard their cry because of their taskmasters. He knew their sorrows up there in heaven. And he had come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and large land. To, and here it is for the first time, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now, this expression comes time after time in the Old Testament. But we need to think about it. What does it mean, milk and honey? If it was a land which had plenty of milk, that means you had cows or sheep and goats. And that meant you had green pastures to feed these animals on. Something, of course, you don't have very much in Egypt, because it's a land mostly desert, apart from the strip on either side of the Nile. And honey. To get honey, you have to have bees. And bees have to have flowers and trees in order to find the pollen and nectar that they need to turn into the honey. So again, a land very different to the land of Egypt, where what flowers there were mostly cultivated ones, and very few trees, certainly no forests, in the land of Egypt. Most of their timber for building, indeed, was imported from far away. So turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 7, for a moment, and you'll see another description there of the water that will be abundant for them when they got to the promised land. So different to the land of Egypt that they come from. Deuteronomy 8 verse 7, "The Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains, and depths that spring out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land where thou shalt eat bread without scarceness, thou shalt not lack anything in it." Now that was a wonderful promise to wave in front of these parched, weary slaves in Egypt who had hardly ever seen rain. You probably know it only rains for one or two days a year in the land of Egypt. They have a land where it was always raining, and there were actually rivers floating down from the hills that could then bring life and crops to spring out of the ground. That was a wonderful idea, so different to what they were used to. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 11, which we read. One little point I'd like to pick up there, technical point really. Verse 10 of Deuteronomy 11. "The land where thou goest in to possess it is not as the land of Egypt from which ye came out." This is Moses, of course, in the wilderness, looking back from where they were in Egypt. "Not as the land of Egypt from whence ye came out, where thou sowest thy seed and waterest it with thy foot as a garden of herbs. The land whither thou goest to possess it is a land of hills and valleys, and drinketh water of the rain of heaven." That little expression, "waterest it with thy foot," is an interesting one, because it's a reference to to the kind of irrigation that takes place in the land of Egypt, where nothing grows without water from the Nile. In fact, farming in Egypt is extremely labour intensive because of this. Any crop that has to be grown needs a lot of water to be drawn from the Nile to allow it to flourish. Here's a picture taken from the internet of a fellow in raising water from the Nile. You see how painful it would be if every bucket you had to raise from the Nile to pour on your vegetable patch came that way. And that's what they were used to, the Israelites. And they've been there for 200 odd years, doing that year after year. And watering it with the foot, this means what we call furrow irrigation. Actually, even today, with all the developments in irrigation by the Israelis and so on, and tubes and pipes and things and pumps, still most of the crops on this earth that are artificially watered are watered by furrow irrigation. And you can see this in the picture, it's an Egyptian picture here, the stream of water coming from the Nile, and it splits out along the border of the field into channels which run down through the crop. It comes out a bit better in this next picture here. You can see it's just been flooded, this particular section. And down the furrows, the water's allowed to run for perhaps an hour, a couple of hours. And at the end of that time, you walk along, and with your foot, you seal off the entrance to each furrow, so that the water then drains down into the soil and moistens it for your sowing of your seeds. And the water then moves on further down the field to the next lot of furrows, which you irrigate with your foot in that way. How different then, this idea of rain coming down from heaven free just like that, and you don't even have to walk to enjoy it. It was a wonderful thing to wave in front of them, this dream. Of course, at that time in Egypt, they had no freedom. They had no property of their own, perhaps a miserable shack in which the family lived and bred and fed. And the promise of having each family having a farm of its own must have been, something that you could hardly believe. And that Moses, of course, on Mount Sinai, explained to them, as he expounded the law of Moses, how things were going to work out. When they got to the Promised Land, each family in Israel would have what we would call, perhaps, a small holding. A patch of land, perhaps, two or three acres or a couple of hectares, sufficient to provide food for that family. And the boundaries will be carefully marked out. You remember it talks about not moving the boundary stone so often in the Old Testament to make sure that that piece of land stays the same size year after year. And it will stay in that family in perpetuity, because the law of Moses had this ingenious and admirable system where every 50 years, whatever had happened to the family in the meanwhile, they were able by law to go back to their original inheritance and start again. So even if they'd been sick, or somebody had committed a crime and been taken away or gone into slavery, at the end of every 50 years, every family could go back to the same piece of land and start again. And so they had the means by this, they had the means to produce their food, their drink, and clothes to wear forever and ever, if they were faithful, of course, to God and kept his commandments, and he then would protect them and give them the blessings that were promised in the law of Moses. There's no law on earth before or since that's had such an ingenious and fair and just way of ensuring people can live, every family can live happily and in health all their days. Well, when the spies were sent out by Moses and they went through the Promised Land for the first time for 6 weeks, you remember, up the right hand side and back down the left, they told Moses when they got back, it's exactly as you said. We went to the land where you sent us. This is Numbers chapter 13 and verse 37. We went to the land where you sent us, they said, and it truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. And you remember, they had to carry the bunch of grapes on a staff between two spies because it was so enormous. Just one bunch of grapes. And there were figs and other things as well that they brought back to show the produce of this land that God had promised them. And when eventually all the fighting was over and the Israelites had settled down each into his own family unit, you remember the very first crop that was harvested, the law said they must bring a sample of that to the place where God's name was placed, to the tabernacle. And they had to say out loud, God has brought us to this place. This is Deuteronomy chapter 26, verse 9. God has brought us to this place and has given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And now behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which you, O Lord, have given me. So every Israelite confirmed that promise that God had made through Moses with his very first crop as he came to present it to God in thanksgiving. for all that God had given him and his family. All we need to do now, brothers and sisters, for a moment or two, is to walk in the footsteps of those spies in our imagination and try and get a feel of this land to which God had brought them after such a long time. And as anybody who's been there knows, it is a land of great contrasts. Israel has a huge variety of landscapes. As you set off from the Mediterranean Sea, the strip of land alongside the sea, the coastal plain, is very fertile. It's very good for growing heavy crops like wheat and cotton. And then as you climb up into the foothills, you come to what they call the Shephelah. And this area here, as the ground rises, is perfect for grazing cattle and sheep. And the central mountains, the mountain range that runs down the backbone of the land, was heavily forested in the time of the Old Testament. Though, of course, it's not nowadays, because all those trees have disappeared. But we know from various points in the Old Testament record that there were many trees about at that time. And then when you go over the mountain, still travelling eastwards, you drop down into this deep tropical valley of the Jordan, where you have plants that would only come otherwise in a tropical country. Let's have a look at that with some diagrams. Here's a map of Israel, a relief map of Israel, and you can see first of all how small a country it is. It's only 45 miles across from the sea to the far side of the River Jordan, to the mountains of Moab. 45 miles, 75 kilometres. And in length as well, it's not very much. 150 miles, 250 kilometres from down in the north to Beersheba in the south. You could easily drive it in a few hours. It's a very tiny country, considering the impact it has on the world's politics today. And in that tiny land, you have this enormous range of heights, ranging from the peak of the mountain range that runs down the centre near Jerusalem, which is something like 2,600 feet above sea level, 800 metres. You then drop down precipitously to minus 1,200 feet in the Jordan Valley at the end of the top end of the Dead Sea, 365 metres below sea level. And when you look at this on a cross-sectional map, which I'm showing you now, you can see how the ground rises steadily from the sea as you go eastwards up to the peak in Jerusalem, and then it drops down into this deep trough, which of course, you remember from school, is a rift valley that runs north-south with the Dead Sea at the bottom end of it. And then it rises again steeply on the far side to the mountains of Moab and the place where Moses first saw the land. Just before he died. So it's a strange mixture. You've got tropical conditions in the Rift Valley. That serpentine river that runs down is green on either side with palm trees, and climbers, vines. But up on the mountains above, you have snow in the winter. And these deep forests on the slopes. Amazing and very beautiful country. Those of you who have been there, I'm sure, will agree. Looking at it from the agricultural point of view, the coastal plain, which you can see in this map, I've marked it with a ring there, this is the area where in the old days they grew wheat, the main crop for making bread, which we're going to talk about. As you go further up into the mountains, you have the grass for the cattle and the sheep, the Shephelah. On the mountains, of course, you've got timber, the forests, and this is another area where cattle and sheep can be grazed. And then as we drop down into the Rift Valley, the Arabah as it's called, we have the opportunity to grow crops like palms and vegetables, which abound where you've got plenty of warmth and moisture. And then you remember too, on the far side of the River Jordan, the east, in the land of Gilead, there were some tribes of the Israelites who were cattle ranchers. And they found that was an ideal place for ranching cattle because it's a plateau, very fertile, very green, and a very safe place for growing herds of oxen and cattle. So that's a brief geographical and topographical view of the country we're going to be talking about in our talks. Let's have a look at the weather. in Israel, certainly in Old Testament times, the weather was divided into fairly sharp periods. We read a few minutes ago in Deuteronomy about the early rains. The early rains fall in what in England we will call October, and the early autumn here. And the early rains are a softening for the ground to make it possible to sow seeds for the next year's crop. Then there follows, in the middle of winter, in the period December to February, the much heavier winter rain. It might be useful just at this point to have a look at Hosea chapter 6 to see how heavy the rain could be. Hosea chapter 6 and verse 3. Then shall we know, if we follow on to know the Lord. His going forth is prepared as the morning, and he shall come unto us as the rain, as the latter and former rain unto the earth. There you've got the two periods, the main periods of rain, the latter and the former rain. But there's a little passage in Nehemiah which talks about the people being caught out by the winter rain, which was very heavy and made it impossible for them to stand outside. It's the end of Nehemiah. Let's find the place. It's Ezra, I beg your pardon, it's Ezra, brothers and sisters. I haven't put it on the screen. It's Ezra chapter 10, verse 9. You can all see it. I can't see it. It's on my little computer. Ezra chapter 10, verse 9. All the men of Judah and Benjamin gathered themselves together unto Jerusalem within 3 days, and it was the ninth month. Notice that. It was the ninth month. Now, we would think the ninth month is September, but of course you've got to remember, in Israel, the first month is much later in the year, and their year doesn't start in January like ours does. It starts in March. February, March is the first month of the year. So we've now got through to the winter, and between December and February the rain is very heavy. And so it says in verse 9, all the people sat in the street of the house of God trembling because of this matter and for the great rain. So there you've got the great rain of the winter period in December to February. In fact, it can even snow in that time up in Jerusalem. It's not at all unusual. And the latter rains, which come in March, these are the ones that bulk out the crops that have been sown the previous autumn with the early rains. They bulk out these crops and make them ready to harvest. So, as Moses promised, there certainly was rain. And there are three wet periods: the early rain in the seventh month, the winter rain in the ninth month, the latter rains which come in March and make the crops really flourish. But in between those periods of rain, from March through to October, we have the dry season. In fact, from May to October, it is completely dry. There is no rain. So the climate changes very swiftly. And if you've been into Israel, say in March, April, you will have seen the ground covered with wildflowers, a beautiful variety of colours over the landscape. But if you go back just 2 or 3 months later, it's just dry. The grass is all brown and burnt up, and there's no colour because it's the dry season. However, and this comes from Hosea again, Hosea chapter 6, verse 4. There is a very important source of water during the dry season, and that is the dew. And the dew in Israel in the dry season is much heavier than we are used to in our country, because there's a bigger contrast between the day and the night temperatures. And in Hosea, chapter 6, verse 4, using his poetry, the prophet says, O Judah, what shall I do unto thee? Your goodness is as a morning cloud and as the early dew. It goeth away. So the early dew was a feature of life in the land of Israel in Old Testament times. You remember how, how Gideon spread out his fleece, and it was so wet you could wring out a bowl full of water from one sheep's fleece. That shows how heavy the dew could be. Now, I've tried to gather these periods of the year together on a handout for you. What's on the screen is probably too small for you to see from where you're sitting. But on the handout you've got in your chairs, you can see the first month of the year, Abib, in March or April, with the latter rains running through to the 12th month, Adar, in February or March, when the almond trees begin to blossom, and it's the end of the old year in Israel. And you can see I put there, under a column called weather, the effect of the rain. The latter rains, the dry period, the early rains, and the winter rains are all settled out there. And on the extreme right of the diagram, which you've got in your hands, you can see under the column called agriculture what is happening in the farming world during this time. So after that brief peripatetic journey round the land of Israel and seeing what the climate is like and what it will be like for the Israelites, let's go on now to part one of our four talks, which is bread which strengtheneth man's heart. We also look at, in this first talk, at this very important aspect of our and their diet, daily bread. The staff of life, as we sometimes call it. Now the word bread first comes in the Authorised Version in the book of Genesis, chapter 3, verse 18, where our forefather Adam, on the day of God's terrible curse, is told that from now on he will have to win his food from the ground. And it actually mentions there in verse 18, thou shalt eat the herb of the field. Now up to this time Adam and Eve have been eating the fruit of the trees. So this seems to be a change now. They're going to eat the herb of the field. The Hebrew word there is grass, really, although it's not the same word, same sense that it will be used for a cow eating grass. This herb of the field covers a wider range of crops than just grass, and it obviously includes corn or wheat or barley with which you make bread. And the next verse says, in the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread till thou return unto the ground. And if you check it up in Strong's Concordance, you can see that herb of the field and the bread that followed, they do seem to imply that Adam was going to cultivate cereals. And he would also, of course, have to grind the corn to make flour. And he would have to learn how to make bread using yeast and baking it. Quite a lot of technology there, all of a sudden, for somebody who was used to walking into the garden and plucking his dinner from the trees. So that's something perhaps to think about. And we know, as we go a bit further on into the book of Genesis, chapter 19, verse 3, we have Lot baking unleavened bread for his unexpected visitors. Unleavened because he hadn't got much time to prepare the bread. There wasn't time for it to rise, so they had unleavened bread for their dinner. But that implies that normally they would have had leavened bread. So you see, the technology of making bread was there right in those very early days. And we know too from the Lord Moses that, and in fact we read this in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verse 8, that both wheat and barley were going to be there in the land. Deuteronomy 8, verse 8, it was a land of wheat and barley. Now both wheat and barley can be used to make bread. Wheat actually is much superior in its nutritional content compared with barley. But barley bread is mentioned once or twice in the Bible, and it was certainly there. When you look at the table that shows you the agricultural year which we handed out, you can see that barley becomes ready for harvesting quite early on compared with wheat. It's also the same in our own country, of course. In most parts of England now, the barley harvest is over. We've had a good summer from that point of view, and the farmers have finished harvesting barley, but the wheat is still standing. We haven't started cutting the wheat yet. It's the same, it was the same, in the land of Israel, except their barley season started in February, March, much earlier in the year than ours. Let's go to Exodus chapter 9. For a little comment in passing there, based on the 10 plagues, which gives us a clue. Exodus chapter 9, and it's verse 31. The plague of the hail that fell upon the Egyptians' farmers' fields. And it says in verse 31, the flax and the barley were smitten, for the barley was in the ear. But then in verse 32 it says, the wheat and the rye were not smitten, for they were not grown up. So you can see there's a gap between the barley and the wheat. Barley comes first, it ripens, and is harvested some time in advance of the wheat. There's a picture on the screen there, for those of you who aren't so agriculturally minded, of barley and wheat. Actually, I'm sorry, those labels are transposed. the barley should be on the right and the wheat is on the left there. That's a mistake. The barley is the one that has the awns, those long, prickly, hairy things that stick out from the head. And the barley ear tends to hang downwards when it's ripening. Well, how do you prepare the soil? How did you prepare the soil for growing wheat or barley? You have, of course, to break up the soil before you can do any sowing of seed. And in Old Testament times, this was only possible after the early rain had fallen, because the long dry summer had baked the ground hard like iron. Until the early rain fell and softened the ground, you couldn't get anywhere. But once the rain started to fall in September, you could set to work. Now, on a small scale, the ground was broken up using the tool I've shown on the screen here, which is called a mattock. It's made of two pieces of wood, a long handle, and another sort of paddle blade, which is stuck into a hole in the top of the long handle with a peg. And to keep it in position as you use it, as you drag it towards you, hammering away at the soil, a piece of string or rope links the paddle to the main long handle to preserve that angle about 30 or 40 degrees. Now, we have a reference to this in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 25, which might just be worth looking at to pick up this point. Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 25, and this is talking about the curse that would come on the land of Israel because of their impenitence after the king of Assyria had desolated their cities. On all hills that shall be digged with the mattock, there shall not come thither the fear of briars and thorns, but it shall be for the sending forth of oxen and the treading of cattle. And the NIV translation says, on all hills that once were digged with the mattock, now there will be oxen and cattle. Because of course the farmers have been taken away into captivity, and they weren't able to do their annual digging with the mattock, and the land was being used for herding cattle instead, which doesn't involve digging up the ground. So that's a mattock, and you can imagine how hard work it would be. It's only made of wood, it doesn't have a sharp metal edge to it, to have to hammer that into the ground and pull it towards you to lever the clod out of the ground and break it up a little bit. It was a long, hard job. Well, fortunately, the Israelites were able to use animals to help them with this work, and ploughing was the alternative for larger areas of ground. Now, this picture I've got in front of you now is taken from one of the Egyptian tombs and illustrates the kind of plough that was used from time immemorial, really, until fairly recent years. The ploughs in those days didn't turn the soil over like a modern farming plough does in England today. All it did was to cut a groove through the surface of the soil, and there's a sharp peg called an ard, A-R-D, which projects downwards into the soil at an angle. And the man walking behind, as you can see in this picture, steers the plough with a crossbar, a bit like a bicycle, handlebars, and the device is towed by, in this case, a pair of oxen with long horns, pulling it through the ground and splitting open the soil in this way. Here's another picture taken from the Louvre of a model, actually, from the tombs, of an Egyptian slave ploughing the ground between two oxen and pulling the plough, which is just a simple lever going down into the soil with a sharp point at the end of it to break up the soil. So the ploughing was fairly unsophisticated, and it didn't destroy weeds. With our modern ploughs, the steel ones that you see winging up and down the fields, the soil is actually taken as a piece and turned over upside down, so that any weeds or grass that were growing on top now go underneath, where they're cut off from the light and they die, they rot away, and it's into the exposed top that you then plant your crop. So this method of ploughing we're seeing in the picture here, Old Testament ploughing, was much more primitive and not quite so efficient, so to speak. But of course it didn't need so many horsepower either. Well, sowing the seed, that comes next. Oh, sorry, here's a plough. Yes, I went to it's like a living museum in Israel a couple of years ago. No, 4 years ago. It's a village near in the valley of Jezreel called Sephara, and they try to reconstruct life as it was in Old Testament times, and they take you around this place. You actually dress up in a robe as if you, you know, you belong to the period. This is one of the tourists has been dressed up in the robe of the period, and they have a number of these different implements there, including this very simple plough, which you can see in the picture, which is obviously a one horse plough rather than one for oxen, with a pair of oxen. Okay. Pulling the plough with a pair of oxen needed a yoke, and you can see here a picture of an old-fashioned yoke with two sets of prongs pointing downwards, which lodge onto the shoulders of the oxen as they pull together. And this gives you extra power, of course, having two animals rather than one, and a lot more than the mattock, which is purely human-powered. The law of Moses, you remember, forbade putting different species of animals in the same pair of yokes. You couldn't have an ox and an ass yoked together in the same yoke, because of course those animals have quite different gait, different rate of movement, and it would be very uncomfortable for the animals and very chafing for them to have the yoke on their shoulders with another animal pulling alongside. And the Apostle Paul, by the same token, says we should not be yoked with unbelievers, because you can't pull together if you're facing different approaches to life. If you've got different outlooks and objectives, you won't be pulling together smoothly as the oxen pair should be. And on the other hand, of course, Jesus, in his grace, in Matthew chapter 11, offers to be yoked with us and to share our burden as we go through life together. So there's lots of little lessons that come out from the ploughing and the yokes there that were used in the Old Testament times. Okay, let's go on for the sowing now. There's a little verse in Psalm 126. It might be nice to look at now, please. Psalm 126, verse 6. And it's in verse 5 and 6 that our point is to be found. Psalm 126, verse 5. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. He that goeth forth and weepeth, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. Now, what's all that about? Well, seed for sowing was indeed precious, because you see, the sowing time comes right at the end of the long dry summer, and the man who goes out to sow the seed would much rather be eating that for his dinner, particularly if it's been a very bad summer and the crops weren't perhaps very vigorous the previous year. It could be the last bit of wheat he's got left. And of course, if he eats it, he won't have anything to sow and there won't be any crop next year. So he has to sacrifice his present gain, a nice dinner of bread, for the future crop, which he won't have unless he sows it. And so he weeps as he goes forth sowing the seed, but he knows, verse 6, in the end he will come again with rejoicing in the time of harvest. And of course there's lessons there, aren't there, too? We have to sacrifice, don't we, our present pleasures for a future reward, which perhaps sometimes seems a long way away. Well, the seed in those days, of course, wasn't drilled in by machinery, but it was scattered by hand from a bag, like the man in the picture here, which is not an Old Testament picture, of course, but it's an American settler, throwing seed by hand from a bag over his shoulder. And as Jesus points out in his parable of the sower, it would fall randomly on the surface of the ground, including the pathway and stones and thorns and thistles, which would all have an impact on how successfully the corn grew. Nowadays we have machines that put it into neat rows about 3 or 4 inches apart, and it comes up very evenly spaced. Weeds grow up with the crop, and Jesus mentions, doesn't he, the weeds that would come up with the crop, the thorns and thistles in the parable of the sower and in the curse upon Adam, and the tares too, which Jesus mentions. And there are some grasses, like ryegrass, which look exactly like wheat as it starts to grow. You couldn't really tell the difference between them. But when it comes to harvest time, the ryegrass, which you can see on the right in this picture, produces nothing to eat. It's only the crop on the left that's going to give you bread for your dinner. And Jesus says that can be the same in the ecclesia. You can have wheat and tares growing together and you can't tell the difference. And only he, with the angels, will be able to show the difference when the time comes in the day of judgment. Well, we move on to the time of harvest. It's now got through to the summer, and the long dry period is over. The latter rains have fallen and swelled the grain. We're ready to harvest the crop. This is very painfully hard. The stalks of the wheat have to be severed, and the sickle was the tool of choice. And you can see this picture, which is taken from Egypt, but will obviously be very similar to the ones the Israelites would use. You have a wooden sickle, shaped a bit like the jawbone of an animal, like a donkey, but set into the inside curved edge are flints. And these flints, of course, are very sharp and have a very hard edge, which make them ideal for cutting through the coarse stalks. And in the picture on the right, you can actually see an Egyptian slave in a pyramid, a tomb picture, grasping the stalks with his left hand and with the right hand severing them with the sickle. What happens next is that the cut heads that fall into the ground are gathered up, usually by women in this case, and they're bound together temporarily with a little rope made of straw to make a bundle. A sheaf, as you know it from your harvest festivals. And these bundles, or sheaves, were then taken to the threshing floor. Now the threshing floor was always in a windy place, because you need the wind to blow away the chaff from the actual grain that you're going to save for your dinner. And it's interesting that the place where the temple was eventually built, Mount Moriah, was a threshing floor. Threshing floor of Arawana as a Jebusite. And when you go there, you can see it is on the mount, and it would therefore have plenty of wind to blow away the chaff. There's one or two other references in the Old Testament like that too, which suggests a windy place. Well, here's a picture I took a year or two ago on holiday of a modern village threshing floor. And the same floor had been there for centuries. But of course, nowadays, instead of threshing it with handheld machinery, handheld tools, it was a mobile threshing machine that went round from village to village and stopped just for a few hours to thresh the, a call out for the villagers in return for a small payment. And you can see there the pile of grain left behind after the travelling machine had gone on to the next place. So threshing floors in an elevated place were quite common. Now, what's the purpose of threshing? The purpose of threshing is to release the grain, the actual kernel, from the inedible sheath that surrounds it as it grows. And there were two main ways of doing this. One was to allow animals to walk over it, to be trampled underfoot. And that, of course, gives rise to the commandment in the law of Moses, "Thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn." Because the oxen were driven over the heaps of the sheaves, and with their feet they would separate the kernels. But, said the law of Moses, they were entitled to a few mouthfuls of the crop, because they, much earlier on, had pulled the plough, cultivated the field, and it was now their chance to share with you the proceeds that God had given you. But the other way of threshing, which you don't perhaps come across very obviously in the Old Testament, but it is there, is the threshing sledge. Now this we find in Isaiah chapter 41. And perhaps you'd like to have a look at this one with me. Isaiah 41 and verse 15. "I will make thee a new sharp threshing instrument with teeth, says God. And thou shalt thresh the mountains and make them small and make the hills as chaff." Now what was this threshing sledge? Threshing instrument having teeth? Well, here's a picture I took from, actually, in the Canary Islands a few years ago. It is about the size of a sledge, and set into the bottom are small hard flints cemented in. And this was then towed, you see the hole at the end for the rope, towed by the animals round and round and round over the corn, over the sheaf, to burst out the grains from the kernels. That's a threshing instrument having teeth. Another way of threshing on a smaller scale was to use a flail. This picture again is taken from the Egyptian tombs. The flail has a handle and several loose bars linked together with a flexible leather strap, which is then brought down on the crop. And if you've still got Isaiah open and you turn to chapter 28 of Isaiah and verse 26, you'll see here how it talks about using the right kind of instruments for the job. God, in verse 26, instructs him, the farmer, to discretion and teaches him. For vetches, we would call them vetches nowadays, vetches are not thrashed with a thrashing sledge, because vetches are very delicate little plants. And if you put a thrashing sledge over them, you would ruin them. Neither is a cartwheel turned about upon cumin, but vetches are beaten out with a star, and the cumin with a rod. And bread corn is bruised. So appropriately to the crop, you use the right threshing instrument, and the flail was used for the smaller types of seed. The last part of the process is winnowing, where the mixed grain and chaff is thrown up into the air for the wind to separate the one from the other. Remember how when Gideon was thrashing his wheat, he did it in a wine press. Now that's a stupid place to thrash wheat, because there's no wind to blow away the chaff. But the point was, Gideon didn't want to have a big plume of chaff billowing off the top of a hill, which would then be visible to the enemies, the Amalekites, who would see it from a distance and then come along with their soldiers and take the crop away. So he was hiding low down in the pit to thrash his corn in a very unusual way. Right, so last thing then is sieving. If the grain had stones or nasty husks mixed with it, it then had to be sieved to remove the stones. Remember how, you need to look this one up, in Amos chapter 9, verse 9, this is the verse that Jesus quotes about Peter. And he says, Satan's desire to have you. And sieving the stones from the corn was the last part of the process. And here we've got a picture on the left there, of a gentleman holding in his hand a winnowing fan for lifting up the straw and the chaff into the air so that the wind can blow it away. And hanging on the tree behind him is a sieve. In the right hand picture here, a much more elaborate sieve made of tiny strips of bamboo sort of material, but fine enough to separate out any nasties that would otherwise break your teeth when you were eating your bread, if they weren't separated from the corn. And so finally, and we'd have to come, I think, to a conclusion now, the grain had to be then stored for the winter, usually in a dry pit or sometimes in urns made from pottery, where it could be kept dry from weevils and other moles and funguses which would attack it. That was very precious then for the next season. And after the harvest was all over, and it was safe to do so, the chaff was burnt well away from the crop so that nothing could catch fire and be destroyed by accident. You remember how Jesus, in Matthew chapter 3, talks about this last process, the burning of the chaff, with another little word of warning. Matthew chapter 3, verse 12. It's actually John the Baptist talking about Jesus. And it says in verse 12, Jesus would have his fan in his hand. Now the fan in his hand would be like the one you saw in the picture on the left there, the man holding that thing in his hand with the prongs. But his fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly purge his floor, that's the threshing floor, and gather the wheat into the garner, that's the storage place, but he will burn up the chaff with unquenchable fire. That's Jesus prophesied of by John the Baptist. The burning up of the chaff, of course, and the taking of the grain into the garner, not taking place until his second coming and the day of judgment. Well, brothers and sisters, that my time has gone now, so I'm going to stop there. I'll tack on the making of the bread onto the beginning of tomorrow's talk, because tomorrow's talk will allow that. There's enough time, I think, in tomorrow's talk to finish off with the bread next time. So we'll bring it to a halt there, and we'll close this part with a hymn and a prayer. And our hymn, which is 155, hymn 155, talks about our thanks to God for our daily bread. Lord, who thyself hast bidden us to pray for daily bread, we ask thee but for grace and strength this day our path to tread. Hymn 155. After which we close with a prayer.